Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is the Best Ever You Show, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino. And Karen, thank you for joining us. You know, as we were chatting before we went live, I totally spaced and forgot to ask you how to pronounce your last name. Is it Koenig?
I get asked that a lot. It's Koenig as if there's a long A.
That's what I thought, because I'm from the Midwest, and I had a teacher at one point with that name, and I thought it was pronounced Koenig. So I would have gotten it right. I should have just guessed, but, you know, oh well. But thank you so much for being with us today and taking an hour out of your life to talk with us about, it looks like we're going to talk about just about everything under the sun related to eating. Does that sound pretty good?
Yes, it does. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here and look forward to your questions.
Yeah, and for those of you following along with us, if you'd like to go to Karen's website while we're on the air, you can go to her website. It's eatingnormal.com. And I really encourage you to take a look around her website. It's a really nice, clean website, very easy to navigate. And there are several of her books that she has written on here for purchase. And one of them is Nice Girls Finish Fat, Put Yourself First and Change Your Eating Forever, which I'm sure we'll talk about in depth here in a minute. And then the other one is The Rules of Normal Eating. That's a common sense approach for dieters, overeaters, undereaters, emotional eaters, and everyone in between. Now, Karen, if I qualify for like all of those things, dieter, overeater, undereater, emotional eater, everything in between, what do I do?
You read the book.
Yeah, and tell me a little bit about, you know, I am sick of dieting. I'm sick of binging. I'm sick of dieting. I'm sick of depriving myself of everything and obsessing about my weight. So what's a great step to take?
Well, you know, the whole concept of dieting, especially for women, has been to tell us that there's something wrong with our bodies, our weight isn't good enough, just, you know, follow these quick, easy rules and you're going to have this magical, wonderful life. And, in fact, it isn't true. This statistic has stayed steady since about the 80s when I got into the non-diet approach to weight loss movement. And that is that about 95% of people who diet and lose weight regain it, and 90% regain more than they originally lost. And that's because, as you say, we feel deprived when we're on a diet. We look at what other people are eating. We get defiant, and then we do what's called rebound eating, and we tell ourselves, I deserve to eat. And, you know, we're off and running, and that's how people get into the diet binge cycle. So one way to stop is to stop dieting and start following the rules of appetite.
And what does that mean? What are the rules of appetite?
Well, they're very simple and basic, but they're not easy. If they were easy, I wouldn't have to write books about it, and I would probably be out of a job as an eating coach and psychotherapist. But what normal eating says is to eat when you're hungry. You know, you wait to fill up your car till the gas gauge is on empty. Same thing with your body. You want to be moderately hungry when you eat. And if you're not moderately hungry, it means you're eating for other reasons, usually emotional. That's the first rule. Second rule is choose foods that you really enjoy. Because if you're eating foods you don't like, what we tend to do is we don't feel satisfied, so we eat more of them. Or we eat those and then we go eat something we really want. Third rule is to eat mindfully with awareness, not to eat with distractions, at least while you're really learning to connect to your body. Because when we eat with distractions, our brain does not register what we're eating or how much we're eating. And the fourth rule, which is, of course, the hardest, is to stop eating when you're full or satisfied. And you can do that if you followed the other rules. And if you pay attention, you do know when you're done. Then you put the food away, you throw it away, you give it away. So those are the rules of normal eating, and they replace an internal structure. They're an internal structure for eating just what you need.
Right. And what if you're a person who, you know, you say eat what you love to eat. So, okay, let's say I love to eat Twinkies, Ho-Hos, you know, pizza, chocolate, and ice cream. Am I going to be okay?
Well, I eat all of those probably except the Twinkies and the Ho-Hos. I eat sweets every day. You know, I'm a recovered dieter and what I consider a world-class binge eater. Uh-huh. And I lived the first half of my life, I'm 64, you know, as a dieter and binger. And the second half of my life as a normal eater. And I eat sweets every day. I don't feel guilty when I eat them. Therefore, I'm really present to them. I eat them very slowly. I look for a peak, which most people miss. See, if you're eating those kinds of foods and feel guilty, you tend to eat them more quickly, and then you don't taste them, so you don't know when you're done. But in fact, through evolution, our bodies are made to recognize a peak in flavor if we eat slowly and chew a lot and let food sit on our tongue, so that we know that, and then food doesn't really taste as good. I mean, if you're really paying attention. So you eat small amounts of things. I mean, and I don't mean that sometimes you don't say to yourself, well, you know, I'm going to go out for dinner tonight and have dessert, so I won't have this ice cream now. I mean, we have to keep our brain engaged. But for the most part, unless you're allergic, there really are no restrictions.
Right. Do you think that I was looking at some more of your website, and do you think that it's necessary to seek the help of a therapist when you're losing weight? I know a lot of people, there seems to be like a, when you're trying to lose weight, it's all over the place with what should I do? Should I do food? Should I do exercise? It seems like there's this whole part that's sort of left out about all the emotional reasons behind maybe eating or not exercising. Could you talk a little bit about maybe when to seek help from a therapist or, you know, a life coach or something like that regarding dieting and eating and so forth?
Absolutely. It really is important if you have dieted your whole life and regained the weight. I think that the two people that you should have in your life are a registered dietitian and a therapist who can help you understand what's going on. Now, first of all, it's not an equal, even playing field. We don't all start off the same way. If you have a family that are all tall and thin, and you go back two or three generations, and most of them are that way, you're going to have a different beginning then if you look at your family and they're all either, you know, rotund or big boned, tend to put on weight. So there's this myth that, you know, anyone can be the weight they want. Well, in fact, that's not true. We have what's called a set point, which is a range within which our weight falls. And for people who are thin, it's hard actually to put on weight and go above it. And for people who are heavier, it's hard to go below it. So having realistic weight goals is really important. That said, addressing what you said about the psychological, emotional issues, most of the time we're in touch with the reasons we want to be thin or lose weight. But in fact, there are many reasons that we don't. And I've actually outlined another book and started writing it about the unconscious reasons. And the internal conflicts we have that we are not aware of that prevent us from reaching and keeping our eating or weight goals. And a therapist is very helpful in untangling them, you know, particularly somebody who works in the field. So I think it's always helpful to people if they feel stuck to seek help. And it doesn't mean for life.
Yeah, and to not feel bad about it either, because I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, I need to go to a therapist, there's something wrong with me.
Right. You know, there's an old saying, I think it's a Gestalt saying, you don't have to be sick to get better. You know, we do lots of things to enhance our lives. we try to take care of ourselves physically. We take courses. And to me, it's just making your life better. And it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, throw yourself into exploring your history. But I will say that people who have had pretty dysfunctional childhoods, which means physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, other kinds of neglect, mistreatment, a lot of stress in growing up, have a much more difficult time with food, because chronic stress in childhood changes your biochemistry. And so these people are more likely to be depressed and anxious, sometimes phobic, and they're more drawn to food because carbohydrates do make us feel better in the moment.
Isn't that interesting? I didn't know that. That's good information. If you come across somebody, and we do frequently at Best Ever You, because we have a fitness challenge, and we have a dietitian and a fitness guru and some counselors that assist us in helping people lose weight. If you come across a person who's, let's say, 100 pounds overweight, and they want to really trim down, what would you say would be a first step to somebody who is overweight like that?
Well, I know this is going to sound ironic, but the first thing I would say is to stop focusing on weight and start focusing on what you eat and on getting healthy and fit. Because there also is a myth in this country that we hear it all the time. I do not go through a day without hearing it on TV, radio, reading it in paper, magazine, you know, fat is bad, fat is bad, fat is bad. The problem is that unfit is not good for us. That people can be overweight and fit, and in fact be normal or underweight and be terribly unfit and really malnutritioned, malnourished, not take care of their bones. So the first thing I would say is let's focus on your eating and not your weight. And this is very hard for people to do because we're a society of externals. We always want to know, how am I doing? How am I doing? In an external way. We need these rewards and incentives. And that's part of the problem. So I ask people to, if they follow what they're eating and they really pay attention to it, they're going to know if they're losing weight.
Yeah, that's I kind of did that this past year. I really stopped focusing on, I'm a yo-yoer, just personally, and there's a lot of people like me, so, you know, I can use me as an example, but I yo-yo. Some years I'll be 20 pounds overweight, some years I'll be 20 pounds underweight, sometimes I'll just be kind of what I would consider normal for me, and I yo-yo up and down, around, and everything, and right now I've got those 20 pounds on me, and I've lost 10 of them. Over the past kind of year, but really what I've done is just a slow change this time around to really just not focus on those 20 pounds, but focus on the food I eat and my exercise. And I don't know if that's right, wrong, or whatever, but it's really working for me, where I think, you know, do I really need that entire pizza? You know, maybe one piece of it will just be fine. And let's go for a jog after that. And so I've taken 10 pounds off, and it's been pretty successful in doing that. Is that right or wrong?
No, it's exactly on target. It's exactly what I would recommend. Because, you know, yes, there are people who have actual metabolic weight problems.
Yeah.
But I redefine it, it's not a weight problem, it's an eating problem. Yeah. And so you want to start where the problem is. You know, that if there's something wrong with your house, you're not going to, you know, if it's the entire house, you're not going to start with the roof. You're going to start with the basement, with the foundation, and say what's going on. And, you know, the problem with weighing ourselves, and, you know, I was a yo-yo eater for years, and my weight, too, would go up and down, is you get on the scale and you look at it, you know, you hold your breath, you look at it, and you say, I lost weight. Well, there's something in your brain that says, well, then, you know, you can eat a little more today. Yep.
Geez, I don't
right?
know that for
the reward.
At all. Yeah.
And then the other thing that happens
yeah.
is you say, oh, I had a good day, and it makes you feel virtuous like a good person. I am good.
Yeah.
Okay, the other alternative is you look at the scale and you either have not lost weight or, worse, you've gained weight. And
yeah.
then you think, oh, I have to deprive myself today. Well, we know that deprivation will only lead to eventual rebound eating.
Yeah.
And then you feel like a bad person all day. And literally, people walk around like that. You know,
yeah.
I've known people, it's their birthday. You know, they're at a wonderful party. They got on the scale that morning, and they were a pound more than they thought they should be. And they
yeah,
it ruined
no
their
cake.
Whole day.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
it's bizarre,
just ruined the
it?
Whole day. You know,
yeah.
they feel bad about themselves. It's these moral terms we use with food, good, bad. Foods are just
yeah.
nutritious or non-nutritious. There's no morality to it, and there's no morality or immorality to being fat or overweight.
Yeah. We actually had a really neat guest on yesterday, Dr. Larry McCleary. I don't know if you know him or not, but we had him on because he was talking about how fat is actually good for you. And it was such an, if you get a chance, I hope you go back and listen to that call, because when you said that earlier, it was just like, you know, the light, you know, went on everywhere, because, you know, it really isn't about, you know, he would said the same thing, you know, you can't deprive, certain things you probably should steer clear of or eat less of or things like that. But he was actually saying that fat is actually necessary for your brain to function.
Absolutely.
He's a neurologist.
The right
yeah.
fat.
Yeah, and he went through them. Yeah, it was really neat. So, I think that's I just thought that was neat for you to say that to two people in a row. So, what in your opinion are good types of fats? Is it go for it.
Well,
talking.
You know, actually, I'm not going to, because I consider myself an expert on the psychology of eating, which
okay.
is the
yeah,
how and the why, and not so
mm-hmm.
much the what. Which is why I love to work with registered dietitians, because they've got that information.
Good.
So I don't coach people so much on what to eat as, you know, if you eat X, how do you feel after you eat it? How do you feel
yeah.
as soon as you're finished? How do you feel that night or the next day? So I think there's, you know, plenty of info out there about, you know, unsaturated fats
yeah.
and omega-3s. But, you know, sometimes we are going to want something that's not in the good fat category.
Yeah.
And I think that's real.
Yeah. And you don't really, I'm great at doing that. I'll eat something I, quote, shouldn't be eating. And, you know, you just beat yourself up for the whole day and a half following and then go into, oh, I better not eat anything but a vegetable the next day.
And a banana.
Like that. And a banana, yeah. I'll have some pears and a banana all day long and drink water. Oh, awful. Okay, so let's talk about your book, because we kind of touched on the rules of normal eating, but I really want to tackle this Nice Girls Finish Fat book. What does that mean, Nice Girls Finish Fat? Put yourself first and change your eating forever.
Well, I'll tell you how the book came about. This was my fourth book, and so there I am sitting at a trauma workshop, actually, and I was a little bored. You know, I have to take professional workshops.
Yeah.
And I thought, where do people get stuck? You know, where are my clients stuck? And I remembered all of a sudden that when I teach workshops, I have these wonderful, high-powered, you know, high-achieving women in the room. You know, they're heads of libraries and hospitals, and they have, you know, a lot of feathers in their cap. So I go around the room and they say, well, what is your favorite thing about you? Say one thing about you. And they go around the room, and each one, and I've been teaching workshops for years, they say, I'm nice. I'm nice. I'm nice. And so I thought to myself, you know, maybe that's where, and I have mostly female clients, maybe that's where they're stuck, is that they are too nice. And then I started to think about the correlation between the women that I knew professionally and personally who had eating problems and who sort of had what I call it, you know, one crayon, one color personality. They always color in the with the crayon that says they're nice. So that's how the book came about.
Yeah, and so does that mean to not be nice anymore?
Well, what it means
evil?
Is, what it means is get out the rest of the crayons. Men are allowed a whole range of personality traits that women aren't. We're always told, you know, be a nice girl, be a nice girl. Now, I'm not saying little boys aren't told that, but I bet if they did a study, they'd find that nice girl, that girls are told that more than boys. And what happens is we start to let go of or eradicate or suppress other parts of our personality in order to be this cultural, gender-based personality of nice all the time. And it's very stressful to be nice all the time, to swallow your anger, to take care of other people and not yourself. And so niceness, too much niceness, brings on stress, and stress often leads to unwanted eating. So that's the correlation between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage people, look, women are not going to forget how to be nice. So what I do is encourage them to try out other behaviors and add so that they really, they're painting with all the colors, playing all the notes, being all that they can be.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about women, like with maybe kids. Like I have four boys. They're 10, 12, 14, and 16. And so putting myself first at times, and I'm sure every other mom can relate, is, you know, really hard. Do you mean that part of it also, where you just carve out some time for yourself to maybe be aware of what you're eating and exercising and things like that?
Yes, that's part of it. Part of it is making sure that your needs get met, as well as having other people's needs get met. Now, nice girls are often created because they grew up in families where they were taught that their needs were not as important as their parents' needs. Very often in what psychologists call, it was a parent-centered rather than a child-centered household. So they learned that their needs didn't matter. Well, you know, you don't want to go the other direction and be a parent, who only thinks of her own needs, but to be able to balance it. It's not an either or, it's an and, being able to take care of your children well and take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's where people get stymied because they feel like it's one or the other.
Yeah, and since we had children, I have always tried so hard to balance that out, it's really hard to, you know, especially when the last one came home, they were 0, 2, 4, and 6, and there were like four car seats in the car, and so I think over the past 16 years, I think it wavers around. Sometimes there'll be more me time, and sometimes there won't be. But it sort of balances out a little bit. Do you have any other tips that you would share for people to, you know, what are some of the other colors of the crayons that people need to learn how to be other than, you know, nice?
Well, here if I talk a little bit about the traits of nice girls, it's easier then for me to explain how women need to add on traits.
Sure.
We are the born caretakers. I mean, if you had to pick one of the two genders to be caretakers, it makes sense that it's women because, you know, we were the ones who bore and took care of the kids exclusively since the beginning of time. So we are very tuned into taking care, and that's probably in our DNA. The other thing, a lot of nice girls are perfectionists. They have to do everything perfectly. I frequently tell this story of a woman I knew who was doing, she's a fabulous cook. She made a birthday cake for her daughter who was turning 3, and they were having all these little toddlers over, and it didn't come out well. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, or I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning, she remade the cake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's perfectionism. That's stress.
Yeah.
As opposed to say, these 3-year-olds will not know the difference if the cake is slanted. That's the kind of thing we do. You know, our boss says, well, I'm going home. Would you mind finishing this? So not only do we finish it, not saying, well, I have plans too, but we make sure it's perfect. Nice mm-hmm. girls are people pleasers. They're very attuned to others' assessment of them. So it's a trait that needs to be moderated, both the people pleasing and the perfectionism. Mm-hmm. Saying no, that is so hard for women because they're afraid people will be upset, saying, you know what, I can't do this for you, or not today, perhaps tomorrow, or let me get back to you. You know, if you look around the community, you know, it's the women who drive so many volunteer organizations on top of all the other things they do.
Yeah.
And I think primarily being a good, learning to be a good kind of selfish. And that's really, that word is anathema to so many women. They say, oh, I don't want to be selfish. But there's a bad kind of selfish and a good kind of selfish. So if you can add that self-care kind of selfish, mm-hmm. as well as continuing to care for other people, you really have a much better balance.
Yeah. That's very interesting information. Yeah, I always I saw this one show on TV, and it was about tell me about this critter. I call it a critter because I don't know what to do with this type of person when I encounter them. It's a really, really, really perfectly groomed, skinny as all get out, perfectionist eater, maybe Botoxed, hair perfect, maybe hair extensions, everything perfect. And this mother had a just an enormous party on TV for her child. And the child, it must have been probably $500,000 party, I swear. It was just, you know, clowns and tea and fresh flowers everywhere and just crazy stuff. And the child ended up crying and going with the nanny.
Oh.
Kind of could have cared less. And the mother ended up on the table doing a photo shoot. Isn't that wild? So what kind of person is – that's what I mean by, like, there's some people who do – and this ties into eating because there's people that do too much me, and it's real interesting. There's no anything
yeah.
else is what I'm trying to get to with that illustration.
Yes. But see, that's the either or.
Yeah. What's the
you
middle
know,
ground?
A lot nice girls grew up usually with two kinds of mothers. Either mothers who were nice girls themselves mm-hmm. and were sometimes abused or mistreated or neglected by husbands and family members. Or very narcissistic, self-centered, selfish mothers. So, and even though fathers are obviously very important in our upbringing, our social cues and our emotional cues we usually get from our mothers. So either nice girls just copy what mom did, or they say, I don't ever want to be like my mother. She was just so self-absorbed. I was never on her radar. Other people didn't matter. And they go the other direction to become selfless.
Yeah.
And so it's really important, you know, for anybody listening, you know, if you are a nice girl, to say, is this what happened to me? Are there really only two choices in life, to be selfless or selfish? Or can I take the best of both and become a fuller, more well-rounded, healthy person? And
yeah,
obviously, the woman you describe, you know, is full, in a sense, has to keep filling herself up because she really doesn't have much of a self.
Yeah, that was just absolutely wild. And I won't say the show or anything like that, but I was like, you know, and I know some things are done for TV, but, you know, there's no way things can be that done for TV. You know, there's still a person there. And I was just like, oh, my goodness gracious. And I know people like that in my own life. You know, they just are what they are. And I think one point that you just made is really a neat one where, you know, let's say you want to look at your mother and, you know, evaluate what's good and what's bad. You know, not everything about a person is either good or bad, or you can take some of both. You know, it doesn't mean you have to be one way or the other. And that's really, I think, growing up has sort of, you know, I'm 40, almost 42 now, I've really learned that. You know, not everything about my mom is great, but not everything about her is bad either. You just, you know, you take good and bad from everybody.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
I totally agree. No, I totally agree. I mean, that's pure common sense. That part of growing up is realizing that our parents are flawed because their parents were flawed, and, you know, back and back and back. And one way I like to think of it is we have an ideal of the person we would like to be, not a perfect person, but of the traits we would like to have, to be balanced, and to feel emotionally healthy. And so we look for people in our lives that have that, who have that, those traits, and then we also try to build them in ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's another way of going about it, not even labeling them good or bad, but just saying, you know, that's very appealing, the way someone handles whatever, their kids or work. I'd like to learn how to do this.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things are skills. You know, we seem to think that you're just born with ways to do things. And this is all skill-based. You can learn the skill of saying no. You can learn the skill of delegating or saying, you know, I only did a mediocre job on it, but that's all I'm going to do for now.
Yeah.
And most of it has to do with sitting with the discomfort of doing something that's unfamiliar. And
yeah.
The main skill is sitting with the anxiety you feel when you do something in a different way than you've done it before.
We're about at the halfway mark, and I just wanted to remind everyone to visit your website, which is eatingnormal.com, and we're speaking with Karen Koenig. And I wanted to know if maybe we could step out of the eating normal for a minute and just talk about you and all of this wealth of experience and information you bring. Because I'm looking at your experience page on your website, and I just thank you for talking to me. you've got so many things that you've done. Of everything on here, what are some of the things that you're most proud of that you've done or I don't know. There's just a ton of things on here to sort through. What are some great mentions?
Well, I mean, ironically, some days I still wake up and I think, you know, my eating disorder days are so valuable to me. Who would have ever thought that? You know, when I was sitting alone eating and I was into frozen food. You know, I could eat a frozen apple pie or a quart of ice cream, and, you know, go out and maybe I would restrict, but then I would do it, you know, the day after that. So, you know, when you feel so terrible about yourself, so out of control and what's wrong with me, so I'm still amazed that that actually is something that led me to what I do for work. And I cannot think of anything more joyful than doing therapy and writing. So, I guess to answer your question, what I'm most proud of is that I've used what was such a hard time and a struggle for me to help other people with those struggles.
Were you ever very, very overweight and had to lose a lot of weight or anything like that also? Sorry, I ask you something too personal, just tell me to be quiet.
Oh, no. I'm glad you asked that. I was maybe 20, 25 pounds overweight, mostly in college and through my 20s. I was also bulimic for maybe a year and a half. Which
oh,
also
yeah. Is that the one where you throw up your food? Is bulimia
yeah,
the one where
you
eat
purge,
and then
you
throw
vomit.
Up?
I was working at an ad agency, which was not a really good fit for me. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, not happy with myself and trying to stay thin while having a binge eating disorder. So, you know, I thought
That's
it was
fun.
A brilliant solution.
Yeah.
But, you know, what it really has done for me, again, is I can treat people who have bulimia now.
Yeah.
Not just from a clinical perspective, but from a personal one. And I'm able to say to people, you know, I'm not asking you to do anything that I didn't have to do. And I know it's really hard, but I also know it's doable.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that you're, with, you know, with all of your experience and so forth, that you're almost an expert in eating disorders?
Well, I
assessment?
Am in, I'm definitely an expert in binge eating disorder and, you know, diet restriction, also in bulimia, but I don't deal a lot with anorexia. Interestingly, I do have clients who are now overweight or obese who were once anorexic. But for anorexia, I believe the best treatment is a medical team and people who are really skilled in it. And fortunately, I live in Sarasota, Florida, and there are, you know, a number of excellent clinicians here. So when people call me for that, I can refer them. But I certainly am an expert in binge eating disorder, both personally and professionally.
And what's a binge eating disorder? What does that mean exactly? I think everybody knows anorexia. That's where you get really – that's the one where you don't eat. Basically, right? And bulimia is the one where you eat
yes.
and throw up? Just to
anorexia
generalize.
Is a refusal to maintain minimal healthy weight.
Okay.
Now, that's the basic short version. Bulimia is purging after you eat. And binge eating disorder is basically a pattern of eating more than the average person would, I think they say in a two-hour period, but it's really eating more than the average person would with an inability to stop eating when you've had enough food, followed by remorse, regret, self-contempt, self-hate, and doing that very frequently.
And does that mean like a couple pieces of licorice, or does that mean, does that mean like a couple pieces of licorice, or if you sit down and eat like five bags? I mean, binge meaning quantity or binge meaning?
Five bags. Usually after binge, you really feel physically ill.
Okay.
You know, your stomach hurts. There's a difference between overeating and binge eating. And there is BEDA, it's BEDA, is Binge Eating Disorder Association. And if people want to Google that, they can go right to the website and has everything you'd ever want to know about binge eating. It's a wonderful organization.
Yeah. Well, I was going to a little bit here about, I wanted to skip around just a little bit because I'm still looking at your experience and things. And I had looked at this before we went on the air, but there were, you know, there's just so much and now it makes a little bit better sense to me, but I'm curious on this one. And I'm from Minnesota. What did you do with the Minnesota Breast Cancer Awareness Association?
Well, I have a colleague, an MD from there, Lynn Eldridge, who wrote a wonderful book, by the way, about cancer prevention. And she invited me to come and speak, be one of the speakers to talk about how to eat healthfully for cancer prevention and also for people who were cancer survivors. So I was one of the speakers in this wonderful annual conference.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's I was going to ask you a little bit. I wondered if it was that because I was going to ask you if you also specialize in maybe helping people who don't feel so great. And it sounds like you do. You know, if you've got some type of disease or illness or things like that, I imagine that there's all sorts of issues that come up with eating.
Well, quite a number of my clients have, you know, had really difficult childhoods and have a lot of stress-related disorders,
mm-hmm.
Some of which involve chronic pain. And one of the ways that we have learned to deal with pain is to eat, to make ourselves feel better. So there really is a, you know, correlation too, or there can be, between having physical problems, medical problems, and using food in unhealthy ways. It's so pervasive. You know, food is the answer to everything in our society. Had a bad day, eat. Had a good day, eat. Had a mediocre day,
eat.
Excuse me? It's very ironic. We are the most fat-phobic, thin-obsessed culture in the history of the entire world.
Yeah.
And we're absolutely focused in very unhealthy ways on food. It's a very hard thing to untangle.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And here's one. I love this. What about my chip eating, my potato chip binge eating, because he'll eat a bag of them at a time, husband? Do you think he's contributing to the pounds I have on my rear end?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I try to separate kinds of eating. I would say his is, you know, when we're eating compulsively, it's different than eating emotionally. And are you saying that you eat with him when he's eating those chips?
We'll have a few, but not the whole bag or anything like that. No, I don't eat like that. I just mostly, I'm a little bit different, but I'm curious if, I just like that. Is your husband or wife making you fat? I think that's, you know, you eat with them, or they go to the store and buy ice cream and you eat it. And I mean, they're just the whole husband-wife correlation. They seem to travel in pairs.
Well, but there's that, and there's the opposite, which is the spouse that is always trying to control the eating of the other person.
Yeah,
and we know exactly what happens when people try to control us. You know, there's the little voice that says, you know, you can't tell me what to do, and we're off and running. So I often see that dynamic with couples. My advice is, everybody, eyes on your own plate. Just like they used to tell you in school, eyes on your own paper.
I like that.
Eyes on your own plate. You can only change your own eating. And the more we get on other people, you know, the more they resent it. I do think that couples can have, you know, an open, serious talk about, well, how do we want to eat? How can we help each other reach our eating goals? What gets in the way of it? You know, as problem solving, and, you know, I'm all for communication that is fostered by honest discussion about eating goals. I don't think many families even talk about it. They may talk about nutrition, but not what their personal eating goals are and how the other person's eating affects them.
Huh, that's interesting. That's a really interesting topic there. Yeah, I think a lot of people definitely just talk about kind of the food that's in the house, or pick that up at the store, or, you know, make that tonight, or can you make brownies, Mom, or whatever, but they don't actually talk about, they don't, probably. That's a good idea to start, huh?
And yes, and parents talking to kids. The thing parents have to always be careful of is kids are more likely to copy what they do than what they say. So if you want, I don't mean you in particular, but any of us want our kids to be healthy and fit, we have to model that behavior. It is so confusing if we tell kids, well, don't eat ice cream, and other than very young children, but, you know, certainly teenagers, and then we're, you know, off sneaking
in the
bathroom.
Yeah, exactly.
So, because kids want to be like their parents, and it's very confusing to them if they hear one thing and they see another. Obviously, when children are very young, you do want to restrict certain foods and promote other foods because they're just laying down their nutritional and appetite patterns, and you can foster that. But it also doesn't work to tell kids, well, you can never have X. You know, maybe it works when they're one or two or three, but once they're out in the real world, what you want to do is give them the skills to make healthy choices.
That's the best thing
that parents can do for kids.
A couple more things here. We've got probably about 15 minutes left to speak with you. I love this line. Stop feeding your emotions and start feeling them. Can you talk a little bit about that one?
I can. And my second book is a food and feelings workbook. And that came about because after I'd written the book on the rules of normal eating, I thought, why aren't people doing this? And I realized it's because they were really having a hard time with emotions. And, you know, another thing that's really not talked about, what are emotions for? Why do we have them? Does everyone have the same emotions? I did a lecture at a bachelor's level social work class and asked this, and I thought, oh, they're going to have the answers. You know, why do we have emotions? They had as much trouble answering as, if I go and do a talk at the library. We have emotions for a reason. They're our internal guidance system. Our senses are for our external world, and our emotions are just information. There's no good emotions or bad emotions. They're information. You know, you wouldn't shut down your fax machine, your iPhone, your computer. You wouldn't turn off the news because you want the information to know how to live your life. You know, if it's raining today, you need to take an umbrella. Well, if somebody consistently disappoints you, maybe you need to rethink the relationship. So what happens is feelings are uncomfortable, so people either eat to ward them off or they eat to comfort themselves. And I have to say a piece of that is hardwired into us. You know, we're born and usually we're held and fed, and it may not get any better than that. I mean, that's sort of very blissful. So we do have this association between food and comfort.
Yeah.
That, you know, we are taught, and that is in part hardwired into us. Plus, carbohydrates do give us, you know, that sort of drowsy, good feeling for a while. So there is something in foods that does that to us. So we get used to that.
Yeah, that's true. I love that part about, you know, why are we emotional, and if that is a hard question to answer, I can see why you probably got a room full of quiet in a way. And what are some of the emotions that people feel that they feed? Is it just anger, or is it anxiety, or is it sadness, or is it everything? Can you be happy all the time and eat all the time?
There's eating for reward, but let me come back to that. I think the seven most difficult feelings for disordered eaters are guilt, shame, helplessness, and I would put a star by helplessness as the number one, anxiety, disappointment, loneliness, and confusion. But in terms of, you know, we eat for reward, it's very external. As opposed to the best reward is just feeling proud. You know, how many times do people say, well, I deserve this. I'm entitled.
Yeah.
You know, I hear it all the time. But the point isn't what you deserve. If you really feel deserving in life, you don't ever think about it.
Yeah.
It's just there. The same as if you were breathing on a ventilator, you might get off and say, oh, wow, it feels great to breathe with my own lungs. But most of us don't think about breathing because we just do it all the time. Same if people are deserving. It's as soon as you say to yourself, well, I deserve this, that's the tip-off that you really don't feel deserved.
Got it. What does helplessness mean? Oops, I think our phone cut off. I'm not sure. Well, that might be the end of the interview. We'll see if Karen calls back in. I do want to just direct you to her website, eatingnormal.com. And we were talking about emotional eating and some of the emotions that people feel when they feed their emotions instead of just feel their emotions. So I'll stall here for a little bit longer, but I think we're probably done with the interview. So, Karen, thank you very much for being with us today. And please visit us online at besteveryou.com or besteveryounetwork.com. We just opened up this network probably about 4 or 5 days ago, and you can join the network at beynetwork.com. And it's a really neat network where you can blog, you can write anything, or you can upload videos, photos, music, and just engage other people. There's probably almost 100 people in there at this point. And Karen, you did call back in. Sorry about that. I stalled while you were while the phone cut out.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's radio, and it happens all of the time with phones and things like that. So we're kind of used to it. We've had some really interesting radio interviews over the past year with phones cutting out. So don't worry about it. We were talking about feeding emotions and feeling emotions, and you were going through the list of, some of the more, I would call them more negative things that you can think and feed. And I was asking you, what about helplessness? You were putting a star by that one. What does that mean?
Well, helplessness, I believe, is the most difficult feeling for any of us to feel. Because, for a couple of reasons. One is because we feel it practically from the moment we're born. We are born into total helplessness and dependence on parents. Mm-hmm. And if parents let us feel a little helpless, but for the most part tend to our needs and let us know that when we share our needs, they get met, we start to feel more empowered in the world. But parents don't often do that, and then helplessness leads to despair. And that's what a lot of people feel beyond their helplessness. And that's a terrible, terrible feeling. Yeah. And it's very hard to bear. It's not just the helplessness of, oh, I'm late for my appointment. I hate being stuck in traffic. It's the, I will never get to the appointment, and I won't get the job, and I won't ever get a job, and, you know, and on and on. So what happens is often we feel helpless, and then we get angry, and then we get anxious, and we feel like we have to take the feeling away, and we don't. Uh-huh. We can really label it and say, okay, I'm helpless, or maybe I'm not. What can I do? But food is never the answer.
Yeah.
It just makes us feel more helpless.
So what do you think the best relationship that you can have with food is?
Did you say what is the best relationship?
Yeah, what's a healthy relationship with food? What's the best one that you can have?
Not thinking about it 24/7, trusting your body that you will feed it when it's hungry. You will feed it lots of wonderful, nutritious, tasty foods, that you don't have to be a perfect eater, that food is for fuel and enjoyment and not for any other reason, and that you want to think about food in a very positive way and make peace with it.
Yeah, and if you don't, what happens if you don't make peace with it? Is that just a recipe for gaining weight? Or are there some people who eat all the time and have all these issues with food but are just skinny?
Not many as they grow older.
Okay.
Not usually, and then again, they may be unhealthy. I mean, I do know people who are normal weight and they don't eat healthfully, and eventually, unless they have fabulous genetics, I do believe it's going to catch up to them.
like the guy who's eating 25,000 Big Macs. Did you see that guy in the news? I'm like, oh, how are you doing that? He's eaten like 3 Big Macs every day for the past I don't know how long. It's like, I don't know how that's healthy.
But, you know, the other piece is genetically, some people have more of a tendency to put on weight or to get diseases.
Yeah.
You know, occasionally we find somebody who's 100 years old and smokes and drinks and cusses and does everything else that, you know, we can't understand it. Well, a lot of it is genetics. But if you don't know, it's important to do the best you can in taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, the question is, why wouldn't you want to?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And what about addiction? We don't have that much time left here. We have I mentioned addiction with 4 minutes remaining, so take the term lightly. But is this a type of addiction? Some people have drugs, some people have alcohol, some people have sex. Is food an addiction also, or can it be?
You know, I have followed the is sugar addictive discussion in scientific journals as along the way for decades. And the latest that my understanding is that sugar is not addictive, and carbohydrates are not either. But what we do is we form a psychological dependence.
Okay.
And our brain generates dopamine when we eat sugar and fat. And so we like that feeling. But it also generates dopamine when we do other things.
Mm-hmm.
So that reinforces it. But food is not addictive as far as I know.
Okay. Whereas like another substance might actually be, you know, like a cigarette might, that could be
nicotine.
An addictive substance. Nicotine is addictive. Okay, so that's the difference.
And the reason we call behaviors addictive is because the dopamine goes off in our brain and it's the feel-good neurotransmitter and, hey, we all want to feel that again.
Yeah, I get it. I love your website. It's got healthy and donuts and cupcakes and fish and chicken. So it's got everything. Illustrating
it's all fair game.
Everything's fair game. Yeah, exactly. And I really want to thank you for being with us today. And as we wind up, I just want to really direct people back to your website, which is eatingnormal.com, and to buy your books. Now, it looks like some of the books you've written are actually for like teaching therapists, so you're interacting with the general public, and you're also teaching the teachers. It looks like there's a couple books here that are for other.
One of my books, What Every Therapist Needs to Know About Treating Eating and Weight Issues. One of my four books is for therapists, and yet a lot of therapists also use my Food and Feelings workbook with their patients and clients and groups.
Yeah, and the book I really love that has captured my heart is Nice Girls Finish Fat, Put Yourself First and Change Your Eating Forever, which is available at you know, any bookstore or online. It's by Simon & Schuster. So it's just a great book, and it does a lot of good toward, you know, helping you carve out time for yourself and paying attention to eating everything, right? Everything's fair game. I love that because we were joking yesterday in my we only have a minute left. We were joking yesterday in my Facebook that I wrote, I do not like cupcakes. I don't like cookies. I don't like cupcakes. I don't like cookies. I don't like brownies. Meanwhile, we were having a feast here. So it was really funny. But anyway, thank you so much for being with us. And I hope that you will join us in the community and write in the printed magazine and join us on the radio again because it's been tummy opening to talk with you, and I love the fact that, you know, we don't all have to be guilty all the time with what we eat. So thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I hope you join us again.
I will.
So thank you, Karen, for joining us. And again, just to those of you listening, I really do want to direct you to her website, eatingnormal.com, and then also to besteveryou.com and beynetwork.com. We encourage you to really join our network. I think we're going to do some neat giveaways with the first 250 people that join our community. We've got some, it's kind of nice, we've got some cookbooks and things like that to give away, and we'll post more information about that. And we'll also follow up with a post about Karen with some links to the show and links to her website and her books and recap what we talked about. Just some real good information here today. So thank you, Karen, for joining us, and I hope everybody has a great day. Take care. Bye.